Good morning. I now call the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski. I believe he is joining now. I'll circle back. Representative Bierman. Representative Bo.
Swazinski here.
Representative Bo. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Would you mind
present?
Representative Bo is present.
Representative Bierman present.
Okay.
Swazinski present.
Looks like Representative Grunhagen is here as well.
Everyone is present.
I'm present.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, Mr. Clerk. We have a unanimous attendance.
No, we're this committee. So
thank you, Representative Grunhagen. We have a quorum. Representative Akam, have you had a chance to review the minutes from February 24th? And do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move approval of the minutes from February 24th.
Any discussion? All in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. Well, members, we have two segments for our hearing today. In the second half of our hearing, we will have four bills up. And then in the first portion of our hearing today, three bills up. In our first portion of the hearing today, we have a real honor, which is to hear a hot off the presses update from the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, its working group, six assessment. Report that just came out last week, and we are joined by Dr. Robert Lempert, who is a principal researcher at RAND and the coordinating lead author of the IPCC Working Group's Sixth Assessment Report, Chapter 1. So I am honored to welcome Mr. Lempert to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Long. Good morning, Vice Chair Akam, and Minority Leaders Swazinski. My name is Robert Lempert. I'm a principal researcher at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California, where my research focuses on climate risk management and decision-making under uncertainty. I'm also a coordinating lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, Working Group 2's contribution to the Sixth Assessment Report. This report, which focuses on the impacts of an adaptation and vulnerability to climate change, was released last Monday, February 28th. I welcome this opportunity to be here today with you to discuss the report and its findings. I'll provide a brief overview of the IPCC and the process of developing assessment reports, share key findings from the recently released report, and identify strategies that state governments can consider as adaptation measures. So let me start with summarizing what the IPCC is and what it does. The IPCC brings together scientists from around the world to assess for policymakers the current state of scientific knowledge regarding climate change, its potential consequences, and what is known about potential actions that might be taken to address those consequences. The IPCC was founded in 1988 by the United Nations and since then has conducted six assessment cycles, one about every 6 years, to provide the latest updates. This current sixth assessment cycle has three main reports. The first came out last August and focused on the current observed changes in the climate system and described how the climate might change in the future. The third report, scheduled to come out in April, focuses on options for reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change. The second report, released last week, and the subject of today's discussion focuses on the observed impacts of climate change on human and natural systems, the risks from future changes, and how human society and natural systems might adjust to reduce these risks and become more resilient. An IPCC report is a significant effort. To be as comprehensive as possible, the IPCC report has 270 authors from 67 countries, and I hope your handout has the various figures in it. So this is figure one I'm reading from now. And about 60% of the authors are from developed countries like the United States, and about 40% are from developing countries. About 60% men, about 40% women, about a quarter hail from North and Central America and the Caribbean. Together, we read and discuss more than 34,000 scientific papers. To be as transparent as possible, the IPCC produced four interim drafts and solicited review comments on each. And overall, we received and responded to more than 62,000 review comments from scientists all around the world. So what did we find? First off, the impacts of climate change have arrived and are widespread, pervasive, and in some cases, irreversible. In California, where I live, we are experiencing drought and wildfires. Minnesota and the American Midwest are experiencing increased intensity rainfall events, increased flooding, adverse impacts on water quality, increased soil erosion, decreased crop yields and agricultural productivity, and increased heat mortality. As shown in figure two in your handout, current impacts from climate change are being felt in every corner of the world and affect everyone. The chart, the figure two chart, shows impacts on human systems, in particular water scarcity and food production, health and well-being, and cities, settlements, and infrastructure. Climate change is also affecting natural systems worldwide. That's in the upper panel of that chart. For example, here in North America, scientists observe with high confidence change in the structural, terrestrial, freshwater, and ocean ecosystems, observe many species, actually about half worldwide, shifting their ranges northward or southward, depending what hemisphere you're in, and many species changing the timing of their annual cycles. So overall, the impacts have hit natural ecosystems and the poor and disadvantaged the hardest. The report also finds that these observed impacts are just the tip of the iceberg. The risks to humans and ecosystems from climate change are virtually certain to increase in the years ahead. In many areas, the science has advanced significantly since the last IPCC assessment report in 2014. For instance, the science of what's called attribution. Scientists can now do a much better job of attributing a particular extreme climate event and the damages it causes to human-caused climate change. This provides scientific validation for the perception that the climate is changing. It also may have significant policy implications, such as for liability and financial risk management going forward. This 2022 report also highlights the improved understanding of the interconnections among human society, ecosystems, and the climate. And so that's figure three in your handout. As shown in that figure, human activities cause climate change, which in turn affects society and ecosystems. Humans affect ecosystems which have intrinsic worth and provide services to humans. Understanding these interconnections both improves understanding of risks and suggests new and more effective ways of reducing these risks. We'll cover some of those in a second. Compared with previous assessments, this IPCC report has a strong focus on solutions, and our report has a particular focus on adaptation, that is, people and natural systems adjusting to the impacts of climate change. Adaptation planning and implementation are increasing around the world. The report finds many examples of adaptation that successfully reduce risk, enhance resilience, and generate co-benefits. For instance, enhancing natural water retention by restoring wetlands and rivers, along with land use planning that moves development out of floodplains, can significantly reduce flood risk while also providing recreational areas and enhancing biodiversity. As shown in Figure 4 in your handout, the report assesses a wide range of adaptation options according to their effectiveness, their feasibility, and the extent to which they have the potential to produce outcomes that are fair to everybody involved. But the report also describes a number of ways in which adaptation is falling short. First, most adaptation to date has been incremental, focused on current rather than future climate change, and is not keeping up with the accelerating change we see. The report identifies many adaptation gaps, that is, the difference between actual levels of adaptation, what's actually going on, and the levels required for acceptable and equitable risk reduction. Reducing these gaps would require adaptation at significantly higher speed and scale. Second, adaptation has limits regarding the amount of change it can adjust to. At some point, most systems reach what is called their limits to adaptation. Some systems have already reached their limits. For instance, we look around the world, many of the world's coral reefs are dying off because they can no longer adjust. Some coastal communities here in the US and worldwide have been displaced, already been displaced by sea level rise. The report finds that many other systems will begin to reach and exceed their limits as global warming levels rise. Finally, if not planned and implemented properly, adjusting to climate change can lead to what the IPCC calls maladaptation, that is, unintended consequences. For instance, building a levee to reduce flood risk can cause more people to move closer to a river and thus be at greater risk as large floods beyond the design criteria of the levee become more common. Often, maladaptations include inequitable outcomes where actions that reduce some risks create new risks for others. The report offers guidance on how adaptation might become more effective. First, if we don't get greenhouse gas emissions under control, the challenge becomes increasingly unmanageable. More and more systems will cross their limits to adaptation. The next IPCC report, the one coming out in April, has a specific focus on mitigation, that is, options for reducing such greenhouse gas emissions. Our report highlights the importance of integrating adaptation and mitigation along with sustainable economic development. Planning and implementing these actions together enhances synergies among them and reduces trade-offs. Second, it's more effective to work with nature than against it. For instance, using natural systems as a supplement or alternative to structural flood control measures can benefit both people and nature. Third, the report identifies some key enabling conditions that can help accelerate adaptation and move from incremental to more comprehensive solutions. These enablers are finance, governance, capacity building and knowledge, and technology. I'll focus here on knowledge capacity building as one important area for improvement. For this IPCC report, hundreds of scientists scoured the literature looking for evidence of which adaptation actions work, which don't work, and under what conditions. Although the information base is growing substantially and is much better than it was at the time of the last IPCC report, our understanding of adaptation effectiveness is still in its early stages. We all, including states like Minnesota, can usefully do a better job of assessing and sharing information on what's working and why. Finally, this is an all-hands-on-deck problem. No one group, not a state government, nor the federal government, can address it all alone. Effective solutions emerge from collaboration among all levels of government, the private sector, civil society, tribal groups, and others. That said, this report identifies a number of options that state governments might consider pursuing. States can ensure that building codes, infrastructure investments, zoning, land use, and related guidance are based on the best available future-looking climate information, not historical records of past climates. Similarly, states can ensure that financial incentives, such as insurance and financial disclosure, reflect the best available climate science. States can develop and implement their own climate action plans, including adaptation and resilience, and also require local and tribal jurisdictions to have such plans. These plans assess climate-related risks, identify risk-reducing actions, implement those actions, monitor effectiveness, and then adjust over time. States can help their businesses, farms, local jurisdictions, and others plan and implement adaptation by funding and supporting capacity building, and by providing climate services, including research, information repositories, websites, and decision tools. States can support equity through inclusive governance processes and financial support for disadvantaged and at-risk communities. Finally, state governments can improve the tracking and monitoring of adaptations, efforts, and budgets. Let me leave you with one last thought. The IPCC has been conducting these scientific assessments of climate change for close to 35 years. Previously, climate change was often seen as something we needed to prepare for in the future. But climate change is now affecting us in the present. People can see that with their own eyes. This IPCC report makes clear that some sort of transformation, that is, some type of fundamental change in human and natural systems, is now inevitable. We can choose to take actions that guide this change along pathways we desire, or we can experience change inconsistent with our goals and aspirations. This report helps clarify the challenges and offer some guidance on solutions. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lempert. That was incredibly powerful and sobering testimony, and leaves us with a lot to think about and some important recommendations as well. One question I have, you've mentioned that these reports have been happening for 35 years, and I've read them over the years, and I've noticed the language has gotten stronger and more certain. In early reports, there were high likelihoods, and then significant likelihoods, and now we're at the point of virtual certainty. And I'm wondering if you could just speak to what that evolution has meant and what is required from that enormous group of scientists you mentioned to get to a point where you were speaking in terms of virtual certainty.
That pattern is what's going on. I mean, really two things are happening. One is the science has gotten increasingly better. The IPCC considers multiple lines of evidence, everything from observations to, looking at radiation balances to modeling results. So multiple lines of evidence. And so that has become increasingly solid. And then the way a scientist would say it, the signal has emerged from the noise. I mean, the climate has a lot of natural variability, but over the last 35 years, the signal of human-caused climate change has gotten larger and larger. And so the science has improved, but also the signal has improved. And so those two things have come together. And as you say, I mean, gone from confidence to virtual certainty that what we're seeing has a very strong human footprint.
Thank you, Dr. Lempert. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just to the presenter, last week we had a presenter also kind of talk about, the costs of reducing the temperature by 1.5 Celsius. And I think the world cost was estimated at like $28 trillion. Do you feel like that would be adequate to do what you're, proposing could potentially happen? What are your estimates on the cost to get the result that you think would be adequate to do what you think we need to do? And I have a follow-up.
So, I mean, thank you for the question. I think much of what you're asking is about what's in the Working Group 3 report, so the one that's going to come out in April, which is what are the options and costs for various emission reduction paths. And in particular, I think you mentioned the goal of trying to ambitious goal of trying to hold temperatures, the increase in temperature to within 1.5 degrees Celsius. So that's not my area, and so I'm not going to comment on specific numbers there. But just to say, I mean, a lot of those numbers have to do with the large amount of investment which would is going to be needed over the next decade to provide energy to many parts of the world, the Indias, the Chinas, the Africas, which currently have many people, billions of people exist in energy poverty. So huge amounts of capital are going to investment in capital are going to need to go into raising their ability to have lifestyles like Americans do. And then the question is, what is that invested in and what's the incremental cost of a low emissions path versus a high emissions path? So, but I definitely encourage you to get someone from that report and come talk to you. If you like, we can dive into some of the benefit costs and the cost on some of the things that I've been talking about, which are our climate resilience actions. So we can do that. But if you have a follow up question, we could go there first.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert.
Representative,
I appreciate your time on that.
I just wanted to note that we have five hands, and so if we could keep the questions and the responses as brief as possible so we can get through as many, that would be great. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. Mr. Lempert, did you say you're from California?
I am, yes.
Okay. One of the debates we're having here in the Midwest is kind of the land use side of renewable energy. And, obviously the Midwest is kind of the breadbasket of agriculture. We provide a lot of food, just as like the Central Valley does in California.
Yes.
And really, we've been, having a big debate here, whether from an agricultural and food production side, and then solar farms, and, trying to maintain both. And we have, tons of prime farmland. How is that conversation going in California? We're really trying to protect ag producing land for food production, and then the rest. And what are those conversations like there in California?
Dr. Lambert, I know you're not a state of California official, but if you want to speak to what you know, feel free.
Yeah, let me touch on that on that briefly. I mean, I alluded quickly in my testimony to considering mitigation, that is reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and adaptation, becoming more resilient to the impacts of climate change together. And what you're asking about, particularly land use, is touching on that. And there are some proposals for biofuels and others that are very land intensive, and that has implications back for food security and such so forth. In California, a lot of those land use discussions have to do with the extent to which we use relatively pristine desert lands, not agricultural land, but desert lands for say solar energy generation versus using rooftop solar. And there's pros and cons on both sides, and the land use challenges of decarbonization are significant. So I think a lot of there's real virtue in using rooftops and others distributed generation. But let me you're really asking questions for Working Group 3. So I just encourage you again to get someone from the next working group to come in about 6 weeks to come talk to you on those issues.
Sounds like a good recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lambert, for being here today. And I will just say, just given the last question about agriculture, there was an article in the paper last week that said if we do not address climate change, we will lose 8% of agriculture land around the planet because of flooding. And so if agriculture is an important sector, and I believe it is, we really do need to address climate change. And so, Mr. Lambert, I just want to say that thank you again for being here. Last fall was able to attend the COP26, the United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow. And while I was there, I saw a presentation. Part of it I understood and knew, and that was that the United States is the second largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. What I didn't know, however, was that the Midwest, of which Minnesota is a part, produces 32% of our greenhouse gas emissions nationwide. And so that, along with the fact that we aren't meeting our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, we certainly have our work cut out for ourselves. As you pointed out, the next report will talk about greenhouse gas emissions and their ability to or what we can be looking for and doing to address that. But my question for you today is really around the notion you brought up of attribution and to connect climate-related events to the damages. And I think that's a really important piece. And we did hear last week about, you know, some of the fact that we're having large extreme weather events that are costing a lot to clean up after for mitigation. And so in figure four, you also talk about kind of some effectiveness and feasibility of adaptation options. And so are there, you know, kind of best practices? What are some of the biggest that we should be focusing on here in Minnesota and the Midwest to be more adaptive to our changing weather that we're already seeing?
Dr. Lemper.
Yeah, good question. And I'm not going to be able to give you a comprehensive answer. I mean, so the best answer is to dive into the report and others, because in part, I mean, many of these adaptation options are really context dependent. I mean, depend where you are. But, you know, my understanding, I mean, is that among the big issues that you face in the Midwest and particularly Minnesota, I mean, is a lot more extreme precipitation events. The general pattern of climate change is where in places where it rains, it's going to rain more and more intensely, and in places where it doesn't rain as much, it's going to rain less. You know, in urban areas, I mean, I think you're going to, a key thing you really need to do is make sure that your building codes and your design standards, land use rules reflect current climate, future climate, as opposed to current and past climate. I don't know the numbers for Minnesota, but there are some places in the U.S. which are still using essentially weather data from the 1960s in their building codes. And that's, you know, you be forward looking in your building codes. And that's going to lead you to things, you know, simple things like larger culverts under the road, more permeable pavement. This report has a big focus on nature-based solutions. So using, you know, recreating at wetlands, riverbanks, forest lands upstream, all places which can soak up water. And, oh, by the way, when you're not having a storm, are pleasant for recreation. So a whole set of things like that work in urban areas. Then in agricultural areas, just much better soil management, both to pull carbon out, but to deal with erosion, and then also water retention are all important things. The extent you have heat stress, urban tree canopies, more reflecting surfaces are important. And then things like, I mean, first, all your disaster risk management and warning systems are important. And then even things like training health workers to recognize diseases that they may be less familiar with as the patterns of what diseases you get well. So there's a whole range of things to do, but that's a quick tour.
Thank you.
Dr. Lemper. Thank you, Representative Bacon. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Lambert. Yeah, quick question.
Representative Grunhagen, it looks like you muted yourself.
Yeah.
Unmute. Oh.
Okay. Great.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Lambert, I have a, you know who Dr. Fred Singer is, I'm sure.
And I do. Yes.
Yeah, the physicist, and he was the founder of the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change. So he founded the organization, or was one of them at least. You know, he's the co-author on a book, Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming, and it basically destroys much of what everything IPCC puts out, including the view that 97% of scientists agree, thousands disagree. Why do you think he would co-author a book with other environmental scientists and climatologists destroying the theory of global warming, climate change, or whatever you want to call it, based on tax subsidies? Why do you think he'd do that?
Dr. Lemper.
Okay. First off, actually, I do know Dr. Singer. Both he and my mother-in-law are Austrian refugees. So we've actually had dinner together some number of times. But I'm not going to speculate on people's motives. But I would just say, I mean, the body of scientific evidence which groups like the IPCC lay out are based on multiple lines of evidence and work hard to look at compare alternative theories to explain what we're seeing, which is how the process of science is meant to work. And while you know you can pick at pieces of any body of science, which is what scientists do and what it's about, there is no viable alternative explanation for the vast array of patterns that we see. So it's great to have dissenting voices. I tend to not like the consensus language, because I don't think that captures what the process of science is. And so I much prefer the overwhelming body of evidence no viable alternative theory, which explains what's going on. It's very much, if you've seen the philosopher Thomas Kuhn's about how the process of science works. So again, not going to speculate on motives, but I mean, I certainly find the overwhelming body of evidence and multiple lines of evidence very convincing. And then just one more point on that, which is I'm very much in favor of what the IPCC does, which takes a risk framework and always asks, you know, what are the consequences if we act in this way, if we're wrong? And I think that also points toward taking some types of preparatory action for what we're seeing going on around us.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up comment.
Follow-up, Representative Gruhan, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would just encourage you next time you have dinner with Dr. Singer to find out why he co-authored a book to show that climate change and global warming is a bunch of tax-subsidized lies and deceit. It would be interesting. You might want to change your position. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen, for the suggestion. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Lempert, for your testimony and participation with us. I've appreciated Representative Akam and Representative Swedzinski's questions around land use. And something I think a lot about in the context of reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts about the best strategies to both reduce greenhouse gases in the transportation sector, as well as land use policies in transportation and the nexus between those two and how we can have those working together as a viable strategy. I know that land use, cleaner cars, electric vehicles, public transportation, reducing vehicle miles traveled are all strategies that can be used. But I think the land use transportation nexus is a good one, and I'm wondering your thoughts about that.
Dr. Lempert.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. No, again, I mean, I'm going to strongly encourage you to get someone from Working Group 3 to come, because I do some work in that area. I'm here today in a Working Group 2 person, and so I'm going to take your question and go back to this mitigation and adaptation together point, which is important in this working group. So as you all work through your transportation policies and land use policies, which do need to, as you say, I mean, address the emission reduction challenge. In the process of that, be very attentive to this climate resilience concept. One thing that I think is a very nice framing is that as you plan and build your infrastructure, your land use, particularly roads and transit and other bridges, other types of infrastructure, very much think about the needs of being on low concentration pathways but at the same time, building infrastructure that is resilient and robust to higher concentration pathways, if that's where the world ends up. So, you know, while you may want to have infrastructure that reduces emissions, it should also be resilient against a world in which we may have more intense rainfall events, high heat events, and that sort of thing. So as you address those questions, do fold in this other dimension as well, would be a recommendation.
Representative Horsey.
Mr. Chair, very quick follow-up. I appreciate that. And we had a speaker Tuesday that referenced Hurricane Harvey, for example, in Houston. And do you just quickly have any thoughts about that as a case study in terms of resilient infrastructure?
Dr. Lempert.
I mean, 2 points on that. One is that does highlight the importance of, land use decisions and, both where you build and then how a pattern of building is going to increase or decrease flooding. So that is it highlights that very important set of considerations. And again, where the you may want to be interested in more nature-based solutions using the lowest parts of the floodplain for more recreational biodiversity uses and getting construction a little bit higher ground. And then just the other lesson there is that's just one more instance about that the climate has shifted, and what we used to think of as a 1 in 100 or 1 in 500 year event, which means we get one every one century or five centuries, now are much more frequent. And so storms like that have really highlighted that that storm intensities are and frequencies are much different than they used to be, and we need to bring that into our planning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Lempert.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Lempert, for your time today and kind of going through your report. What I kind of skipped to at the end of your report, I got it right in front of me, is I read the recommendations for state government. Just kind of going through this, I just kind of outlined some big things. One was financial incentives, climate action plans, funding research, websites, decision tools, and tracking. And those are all great things. Unfortunately, I kind of have the belief that's a little bit of virtue signaling for the issue of climate change. My biggest thing on here is, why wasn't there any discussion or talking about of critical mineral acquisition and making sure that our technologies, our adaptations like you were talking about, are actually doing what they're supposed to do and be, climate neutral impacts, right? Carbon sequestration, all that stuff. I'm just wondering why that wasn't in the recommendations for state governments to be looking at as we're building things, because I think it's a huge hole in the report.
Representative Igo, I think I can answer that. Dr. Lempert said multiple times that there's a third report coming out, which is looking at solutions, and he's focusing on mitigation and adaptation. But I'll let Dr. Lempert chime in if he has additional comments.
Well, Mr. Chair, I apologize, but if you're going to put in here financial incentives and climate action plans, you could easily list making sure you acquire minerals and critical minerals to build the solar panels, wind turbines, and carbon sequester possibly. So I just, Dr. Lempert, please.
Dr. Lempert.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the topics you mentioned are all important. Are in the working group 3, and I should probably have made clear when I said climate action plan that I was referring to the part that has to do with the adaptation resilience, though. Clearly, a climate adaptation plan needs to deal with the topics you're discussing as well. So, my apologies for not making that clear in this text. There are a lot of technologies that do apply in this robustness, resilience, adaptation side as well. But I take your point.
Thank you, Dr. Lippert.
Thank you.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Lempert, first of all, for your critically important work, and second, for being with us today. So I'm very interested in the intersections of climate, energy, and agriculture, and in resilient agricultural systems. I'm looking at figure four, effectiveness and feasibility of adaptation options, and the food security section. I understand what improved cropland management looks like and what that means. I'm wondering what efficient livestock systems, what that means, and if you could say more about that. So I'm interested in agricultural systems that mimic ecological systems and the potential there, but I'm wondering if, you know, what you mean by that phrase.
I think I may need to get back to you on that and dive into the report. I was not involved with that particular part, but I'd be happy to dive into that a little bit and at least point you to the sections which discuss that more.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Lippert. I'd appreciate that. I think food security is critically important, and making sure that we're adapting in ways that are effective and rooted in science is critical too. So I'll look for that information when you can share it.
Okay, great.
Dr. Lempert, those are the questions our committee has for you. I just want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us and for your incredibly important work on this report. It is sobering information. It is information we need to be taking to heart as a state. And I think the recommendations you have in here, many of them are ones we've heard in front of the committee for climate action planning, for doing additional resilience work. And I just want to thank you for your time with us today.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your questions and your attention. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. All right, members, we are moving on to our bills. And the first bill we have up today is House File 3043. Representative Stevenson, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3043 to be laid over.
Representative Stevenson moves House File 3043 be laid over for possible inclusion. Please tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is an RDA proposal relating to a geothermal demonstration project at a school in the Unaka-Hennepin School District. We, of course, are familiar with the various forms of clean and renewable energy in this committee. We've talked a lot over my time on it about wind and solar. We have not talked as much about the power that geothermal potentially has here in Minnesota, both for heating and for cooling. It can be used for both, interestingly enough. And in particular with our schools, I think the potential for geothermal to be an energy-saving, money-saving venture is really extreme, especially as we look to add cooling to a lot of schools that were built a long time ago and didn't contemplate that they would need cooling in Minnesota. So what we are looking to do here is do a demonstration project at a school that operates year-round, because it's an early childhood facility in Coon Rapids, just to establish some familiarity, establish some of the good things and bad things, obstacles, so other school districts from around the state can look at that to understand if geothermal makes sense for them. In some ways, we know that geothermal is a little bit behind, you know, solar, for example, where we have a much more established program around the state to get solar on schools. There's a blank appropriation in 3043. I believe the request is for $6.5 million out of the RDA. And with that, Mr. Chair, I know there are a couple people here to testify.
There are. First, we will hear from Greg Cole, Director of Operations for Anoka-Hennepin School District. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for having me today, and I'll try to keep my comments brief. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for the Anoka-Hennepin School District. We have over 50 facilities in our school district. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak today and want to thank Representative Stevenson for reaching out to us for this possibility. Folks may not know that our facilities, because we sit in Hennepin and Anoka counties, we work with both Conexus Energy and Xcel Energy. We are actually Conexus Energy's biggest customer, and so we partner with them and also really look at all sorts of different ways that we can be more efficient with our facilities as we continue to have challenges with regard to heating and cooling all of them as efficiently as we can. And we are always thankful for the dollars we receive from the state to maintain our facilities. But with that said, we also take our fiscal responsibility to our taxpayers very seriously with regard to maintaining our facilities in a responsible way. And so when we look at projects like geothermal, one of the reasons that, you know, it's something that certainly we've been interested in, but we tend not to be big risk takers with our facilities. And so when Representative Stevenson reached out with this possibility, we were very interested. The idea of reducing our carbon footprint and simultaneously reducing energy costs for our taxpayers seemed like a win-win for us. And we picked a facility in collaboration with Representative Stevenson that we felt would be, it's not a huge facility. You know, it's about a little over 40,000 square foot facility. So we felt like it would be a great test case to see, you know, how it works, how efficiently it runs. And our hope would be that, you know, the data that we get from that will help us as we move forward in the future.
So much, Mr. Cole. Next, we will be hearing from Tony Poole with Pipefitters Local 455. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me. My name is Tony Poole. I'm a business manager from the St. Paul Pipefitters, St. Fitters Local 455. I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk with y'all. I just kind of want to talk a little bit about some of the benefits of geothermal as it pertains to obviously creating carbon-free heating and cooling, but also some of the economic benefits, whether it's like Zach said, that Representative Zach, about, you know, taxpayer savings, as well as putting people to work. You know, geothermal systems use hydronic heating and cooling, which is water. There's no hydronic heating and cooling system has a better heat transfer than air. For example, a 3/4-inch water pipe has a better heat transfer than an 18-inch ductwork. So using geothermal systems, there's nothing new. Well, there's nothing new about using hydronic heating and cooling, right? We're putting in those systems every day. But if you utilize those with geothermal type systems, they become more cost-effective, more efficient, and carbon-free. Just to kind of give you some examples, you know, recently we did a project at our training center using geothermal technology, and we worked with contractors, but we also worked with Xcel and a group called the Wilden Group. They do studies on cost savings for us. Our system alone, the studies that they did would have a cost reduction of about 85% for our cooling system, which is unbelievable. I like to say that, you know, this is providing nearly free air conditioning for our building. It's only cost that we have is the electricity using for the pumps. So, you know, we, like Zach said, it can be used for heating and cooling. Our building right now is using it for cooling. But there are many different types of geothermal exchange, there are different types of geothermal systems out there. Our building is roughly 100,000 square foot, to put that in perspective of how much that reduction, 85% reduction in cooling costs is. That's a very sizable number. We just recently completed the project. So after this summer, we'll have full data to be able to share with any group that's interested in that. You know, geothermal systems are not talked about maybe as much as solar and wind, and I'm here to try to get that more as a kitchen table type conversation, because heating and cooling costs are the biggest cost for buildings right now. No matter what building it is, it's the heating and cooling costs. So finding solutions like geothermal to reduce those costs and reduce carbon emissions, and also keep our members working, not just pipe fitters, but also all across the construction industry, is a plus plus. I know there's a lot of conversation that everybody here is well aware of moving away from the fossil fuel industry. We feel that geothermal systems are a good way for our members and many other crafts to transition into a green energy workforce. So, like Zach, Representative Stevenson also said, you know, there's, when it comes to schools and different state buildings and government buildings, if they were all to start converting to using systems like this, that the savings for the taxpayer would be, I couldn't tell you what that would be, but I'm sure you can all imagine it would be a very sizable number if our 100,000 square foot building cost for cooling went down 85%. So with that, thanks again. We fully support this project or this bill because we think that there's a good opportunity for carbon-free heating and cooling and to keep people working. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Poole. I just have one brief question, and we have three hands. Mr. Poole, we got the opportunity to tour your facility as a committee. A number of our members came, and it's really impressive to see it in practice. We've funded a number of demonstration projects in our committee, a net zero demonstration project, a hydrogen ammonia demonstration project. Just curious if you could talk about sort of where the geothermal industry is in the state and why having a demonstration project like this would help educate more folks about the benefits of geothermal.
Well, I guess I can kind of speak to what I know, right? And I'm not an expert by any means. I know what I can see and I know what I can feel and I know what the bills look like. So, you know, I think that geothermal has a lot of potential and maybe isn't talked about as much as it should be. I can see a little bit of a shift. I can see things like we're here today talking about it. There's a bill to try to on the table right now to try to get some funding for it. So it's moving in the right direction. And I feel that there's a lot of potential that it could go further though. You know, if something like this were to pass and the savings were there, I think it would only build on that from there and people would actually see the numbers there.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, I don't know. I just, you know, it seems like this is kind of being presented like this is some sort of a new thing in Minnesota. I just Googled it, and it looked like Carleton College in Minnesota has already installed geothermal. We've got projects that have already been installed, quite frankly, across the country, in Boston, in Seattle, from coast to coast in schools. And I guess I'm having a tough time understanding why we need a demonstration project when, like, literally 5 seconds of Googling, the data is already out there. I mean, my parents have a geothermal unit in their house. I know bars and restaurants that have them. Like, literally, all you do is have to Google it, and we could. It's a good thing, and we don't need to have ratepayers subsidize $6.5 million. From XL, which I don't even believe this school is in XL territory, to subsidize something that we already know. This is like trying to discuss whether or not wheels are good for transportation. It's obviously it works. I guess I don't see this as being very studious with the funds that are being taken from ratepayers right now. I think it's interesting that it's an interesting idea, but I think it's trying to find information that we already know. So that's just my 2 cents. Thanks.
Representative Stevenson.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the concerns that Representative Swazinski had. I think the first thing I would point out is that, as Mr. Cole noted, Anoka Hennepin is an XL customer. This specific school is located in Conexus territory, but they are an XL customer, which means that Anoka Hennepin schools, who would benefit from this project, pays into XL and is paying for the RDA. So I think. And not to mention, you know, we've done demonstration projects on other things that are outside of the XL territory recently. As for the novelty of geothermal, I think, like many things, it's in technology that's been around for a while, but is very different now than what it was, for example, perhaps when Carlton put in their system years ago, let alone, you know, the residential systems that you're talking about. When I went out to tour the facility that Mr. Poole was talking about, it involved new technology that is not being used elsewhere that really changes the game and makes it have a lot more potential for application in school districts. As Mr. Cole said, there's not a lot of schools, there aren't schools around that have this experience of seeing it, being able to understand how it would work in a school setting actually does have some value.
Representative Aiken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for carrying this bill. I do think that geothermal is potentially a game changer, and especially this new technology, which I think is looking at things in a different way, doesn't take up as much land area and goes down instead of out to cycle. And so I think that it is worthy of a demonstration. And I also was able to tour the facility and Mr. Poole's facility, and it is impressive. I encourage you all to go take a look. My question is about kind of the return on investment. And so I think, I can't remember which testifier said that it cuts, I believe it was Mr. Poole, who said it reduces energy costs by 85%, and that's amazing. And so how long does it take to kind of pay off this kind of a system? I know with solar, it's sometimes, you know, is a range. And so I understand it's not a science, but is there a range that is looked at as far as payoff?
Mr. Poole, maybe you can speak up.
Sure. I'll do my best. So right now, the estimated cost of the estimated reduction of 85% to our cooling costs is an estimated number that was run by the Wilden Group, who is a works with Xcel. Just being that we haven't had a full summer of data, that's an estimated number. Given those estimated numbers, along with some of the other energy cost reductions that we did with heating and electricity, but the cooling costs alone would have around a 6.5 to 7 year payoff for the well system itself. Which would have been equal to, give or take, a little around the cost of a chiller for the building our size. So right now their group is estimating a 6.5 to 7 year payoff at that.
Thank you, Mr. Poole. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is just really brief, kind of a housekeeping question. So, you know, we're really familiar with these systems, right? I'm just wondering what the backup system would be if pumps fail or energy sources fail. Like, I know up north people that have these systems, right, usually we have a wood boiler on backup in case, you know, we run out of propane or fuel oil or something. So what's going to be the plan here? Maybe Mr. Cole can answer that question. Just want to make sure we have a backup so we don't have cold kids.
Mr. Cole.
Yeah, I think that's part of the cost of this project is to ensure that we have backup systems in place. I think to an earlier point made as well, I think one of the things, you know, Carleton College notwithstanding, you know, that we heard from the engineering firms that, you know, put together bids for us was that the temperature extremes that we have here in Minnesota make us, you know, a bit unique than most of the states in the U.S. So those temperature extremes are kind of the reason why we've been a little reluctant to just dive into this on our own. So this is an opportunity for us to kind of to be a test site to see if the system can manage those temperature extremes and help us realize efficiencies at the same time. But yeah, part of that would be ensuring we have backup systems, particularly when it gets really cold. I think that's the area where the backup systems, you know, may be necessary. I think if I remember correctly, when we start dipping below 15 degrees.
Thank you. Yeah, you lose your coefficient when you start dipping below those temperatures. So I just want to make sure we're looking at, you know, steady, reliable power sources that will continue to keep that building warm. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Mifflin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of something that I've known about for probably the better part of two decades. The church that I attend put in this same system in the earlier generation where we did it all vertical. Now we do, or I'm sorry, horizontal, where now we do it vertical, but we haven't had any issues since 2002, even in the horizontal field design theory that we used to do with the weather extremes. This technology has been very proven. It was the return on investment earlier on was kind of way longer than it is now, especially now that we do these vertical systems. But this is a very well-proven technology that, especially in a commercial type application, sometimes in residential, depending on your age, the return on investment might be a little tough. But back to what Rep. Srinsky said, this technology has been known for a long time. It's very effective. It's very efficient, especially in a high usage thing like a school. So I don't know that we need a demonstration project. I guess I have to agree with that, and maybe the author of the bill would like to address that. But, I mean, I've been studying these things. We talk about them and continuing to add year after year and all the improvements. So I think the stuff is out there. It's well demonstrated already.
Representative Stevenson, maybe you can respond and then give your closing remarks.
Yeah, I'll do all in one here, because I think that the idea that geothermal technology has been around for a while and is understood misses the point of why we need a demonstration project. There are new applications of geothermal that Representative Akam, Mr. Poole discussed about how this technology works, but more to the point, as Mr. Cole was saying, like it's just not a it's not a system that is well used in schools around the state, and the potential for savings is really both of energy and money are very high. And I think another way to if you heard Mr. Cole talk about how they were reluctant to do this, I think part of the reason why was they hadn't seen other schools doing it, because there isn't another examples of that happening. The virtue of having a demonstration project in a school is that then a similarly situated school district could look and say, oh, it worked in Anoka Hennepin, maybe we should do it too. And the fact that people aren't doing it right now, despite the fact that it's workable, as people seem to, on this committee seem to know, justifies the idea of doing a demonstration project. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd ask for the support and renew my motion to lay it over.
Representative Stevenson removes his motion, and House File 3043 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Next, we have House File 2698, Representative Christensen. Would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 2698 to be laid over, please.
Representative Christensen moves that House File 2698 be laid over for possible inclusion. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2698 is a bill to assist my constituents and communities in one of the cities in my district to understand and prepare for the closing of the Allen S. King plant located in Oak Park Heights. The plant was originally scheduled to close in 2040, but is now looking to close in 2028. For purposes of planning, tax-based replacement, and community impacts, that date is right around the corner for Oak Park Heights. The bill simply requires the utility to provide their plan to decommission and demolish the facility and remediation information by December 31st, 2025. It ensures transparency for all the ability for the city to plan for the community. I'm proud of the city of Oak Park Heights and Xcel. They have an excellent relationship with each other and they work cooperatively. I'm thinking that this is a pretty straightforward bill, Mr. Chair, and I encourage support.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. I believe we have two testifiers, and first we will hear from Mayor Mary McComber of Oak Park Heights. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Mary McComber. I'm the mayor of Oak Park Heights. Thank you, Chair Long and committee members, for your time today. I would like to talk to you about House File 2698. As Representative Christensen said, the Allen S. King plant is located in Oak Park Heights and is due for retirement in 2028. Originally, it was 2040, so when it was moved up, it really caught our city off guard. The city's been working very hard over the last year and a half to plan for this closure. The purpose of this bill is for the utility company to communicate their plans for the decommissioning and the remediation of the site. This bill sets the timelines for those discussions. As some of you may know, when the plant was built, it was built under the Northern States Power, which is now Xcel. This is an opportunity for the company, the utility company, and the city in the future to continue those conversations as changes come up. Some of you may have gone across the river on the St. Croix River crossing to Wisconsin and may have noticed the King plant. St. Croix Crossing and the plant are in Oak Park Heights. All of you have photos, I think, that were included in with your packets that show the location of the plant, and you can see where the coal storage is, the size of the building. This is for the city to know what are their plans for demolishing that building, what will be standing. As you can see by the coal site, there will have to be remediation for cleanup on that. Maybe the Xcel knows, I don't know if they know yet as far as what their plans are going to be. But as time moves closer to the 2028 timeline, this is an opportunity to keep those communications going between the utility and our city. I want to thank you for your time and your consideration today. And I'd really like to thank Representative Christensen for all of the great support that she's given to our city. And I will stand for any questions.
Thank you so much, Mayor McCumber. Next, we'll hear from Eric Johnson, City Administrator with Oak Park Heights. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson is just here for answers to questions.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Mm-hmm. I do have one question to start us out for either the mayor or city administrator. So when you are looking at possible remediation and environmental cleanup, what are some of the concerns that you have or some of the things that are on the city's mind that you're hoping to get more information about?
Well, the concern that we have is, thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. The questions that we have is regarding to the fact that the location of where the plant is right there at the St. Croix River, which is a scenic, nationally scenic riverway under the Park Service. And we want to make sure that that is cleaned up appropriately. And if there's any type of redevelopment that's going to happen, we want to make sure that it's done properly and then it meets all the guidelines as far as whether it's through the Park Service, DNR, any type of those things that are going to be required coming forward.
Great. And I guess a follow-up question, I don't know if you don't know the answer to this, maybe I'll phone a friend for Mr. Pearson, but I would presume that there will be on the site, some additional coal ash storage or necessitated to maintain the some of the coal ash has been used from the processing of the plant. And I don't know if you all have the information that you need on that so far or what the conversations have been to date on the storage.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the fly ash has been previously stored in Oak Park Heights and is all encapsulated at the St. Croix Crossing, which is now a park. And if any future fly ash has been trucked out or trained out of here. As far as communication that we've had with XL, they do plan to keep a substation there after the closing of the plant. But that is where it is, what the communication has been thus far.
Got it. I don't see any additional member hands. Representative Christensen, any closing remarks to your bill?
Well, just thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for listening, and thanks to the testifiers and Mr. Pearson to be here for questions if needed. I have spoken with Rick Evans, and there is a good relationship between Oak Park Heights and XL. So. Like he said, that there's nothing wrong with having some belts and suspenders here. So, many of these things they do plan on doing, but they support the bill. So I ask for your support also. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Christensen renews her motion that House File 2698 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. And our final bill for our hearing this morning is Representative Pinto's House File 3907. I will go ahead and move House File 3907 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I believe you have a DE, Representative Pinto.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Worked with House Research to just address a number of issues. And so I'd ask the committee adopt the DE, and then I can present the bill.
All right. Representative Pinto has an author's amendment, go to DE2. I'll move the DE2 for Representative Pinto. Any discussion to the DE? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, the DE2 is adopted. Representative Pinto, this is, I believe, the first time you've been in the Energy Committee since I've been on the committee. So welcome. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And yeah, indeed, it's really good to be with all of you. So this is a little bit of an unusual build. There is an area, I'll just give you the background. There is a development in my district at a site of a former Ford motor plant that operated for many decades. It's right near the Mississippi River. And There's housing going in there, a number of great opportunities. And of course, we're looking for to provide energy for that area. There is a place where there were materials that were placed next to the Ford site that's called Area C. It's just the name has been given that area. It's kind of on the bluffs by the river. There is an opportunity to place solar at that spot that then could be used to power on the site. In the meantime, though, there's examination going on as to what might be done, if anything, with the materials that are at that Area C. And so we want to make sure that there's the opportunity to put solar there, and that's all well and good. The concern is that if there is a need to get at that, to get at those materials, that there might be a need to move that, move the solar to be placed in. And so what the bill does is to have funds that would be available from the renewable development account, the RDA, to kind of act as a bit of an insurance policy. And so I provided a little bit of background, but I'd like to have Mr. Pearson provide a little more detail, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Pearson, welcome back to the committee.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, I think Representative Pinto did a wonderful job giving the history and sort of the need for the bill. And I just wanted to join or share my voice in that conversation this morning. And you know, we certainly support Representative Pinto's efforts to find a solution here. And I think what the committee has in front of them goes a long way to do that. As he described, this is a site that has, I think, a real beneficial, or there's a real opportunity for beneficial reuse. It's a challenged site because it's got this large concrete cap on it, and there's been a long conversation about its future. And so I think utilizing it for a solar array meets a lot of, or checks a lot of boxes, I should say. You know, it certainly addresses the community's interest in solar energy, as Representative Pinto described. The solar array is consistent with the city's climate action and resiliency plan. So I think there's some interest from the city perspective. And from the developer perspective, Ryan Companies and their partners, including some of their affordable housing partners, they're building to the sustainable building policy that the state has. And this solar array gives them another tool in their toolbox too, as they move forward with the development to meet the sustainable building goals. So there's a number of benefits here, and we're certainly wanting to partner with those folks as well to try to make this happen, and be happy to dive into further details if the committee has questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pearson. I do have a couple of quick questions. The first is that I'm curious if you could put in context the size of the solar array that would be developed here and how that compares to other solar arrays in XL territory. Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. The site is about a 6-acre concrete cap. And so the way, you know, we're still working sort of on design in that, but it has the potential to host approximately 1 megawatt of solar. Utilizing that 1 megawatt adjacent to the development and the rooftop solar that is foreseen on a number of those large commercial buildings, there is a real, you know, real benefit to the Highland Bridge development and beyond. So that is the approximate size of the development. And in terms of how that compares, obviously when we look to large scale solar projects as a utility, that is certainly on the small size from our perspective. But looking at it in the context of the city of St. Paul, that would be one of the largest solar arrays within the metro area.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of that 6-acre that I've spoken against a number of times, you know, what's precluding you know, a solar garden to just go on this property?
You were a little jumbled, but maybe you want to restate your question, Representative Swazinski.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Just was, you know, is this a solar garden going to go on this property?
So it seems like the question is, this is this a community solar garden? Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and members, no. This is a project that we're proposing to partner with a solar developer and enter into a 20-year PPA where we would, Xcel Energy would be the off-taker of the energy. So it is not a solar garden proposal.
Representative Spasinski.
Okay, sounds good. So what would be the rate of, so if we're, obviously it's more of an expensive than a traditional, what would be your cost you estimate, in comparison to traditional industrial solar? Maybe you went over that, sorry.
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and members, no, that's a great question. From a cost perspective, it is, we went through a bidding process, and so we don't have an executed contract, but using the information we gained from that bidding process, the pricing is similar to what we see in that 1 megawatt space in the solar garden space. It is it certainly falls into that same price point. I think one of the issues here is the reuse of the land. It's from a, when you're developing solar in the metro area, you've got some different challenges in terms of property taxes and land use issues and things. And so we're trying to take advantage of this opportunity for the Highland Bridge development as well as the city. So these costs will be, and this proposal obviously can't go forward without PUC approval. So if this bill is successful, that will help clear the way that we can bring this proposal to the PUC and make those arguments. But ultimately, the PUC will decide this is in the public interest.
Representative Spasinski, any follow-up?
Yes, just to clarify, if this was a solar garden, would they have to go to the PUC for approval?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Spasinski, if it were a solar garden, no. They would not have to go through that formal approval process. However, because we're proposing a different model here, obviously for us to sign a PPA, we do need commission approval.
Representative Spasinski.
Thank you. And then just the ground underneath it, that is owned by the developer, by you, or by the city. Who owns the land on top of that old dump?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and members, the property is still owned by the Ford Motor Company. The master developer of Highland Bridge, Ryan Companies, has a 50-year air lease to use the surface of the cap for this purpose, but Ford Motor Company is the owner of the parcel.
Representative Spasinski.
Okay, so who would receive, obviously there's some sort of a land rental, my guess. Who will receive, will Ford receive the rent money for the land use, or will the Pearson group or the developer?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and members, the air lease was negotiated between Ryan Companies or one of their companies and Ford Motor Company. I don't know the specifics of that. We could certainly follow up and get information. My recollection from past conversations is that there's a very minimal cost to that air right lease, but we could certainly follow up with the details and share that with the committee.
Thank you. And just one final question. Is the solar project kind of key in allowing for the rest of the development to occur?
Maybe I'll go to Representative Pinto.
If the solar part wasn't part of a proposal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Spasinski. And I maybe will direct to Mr. Pearson, but just note that I know it's a really critical part of meeting the clean energy goals for the whole development. It's really a pretty extraordinary site. It's 144 acres, in an urban area. There's really not a lot like it around the country. But maybe let Mr. Pearson, if I can, Mr. Chair, comment on that.
Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think it is a critical piece. Will be project go forward if this ultimately falls short, either because of the risk associated with the site or costs associated with it from the PUC determination, yes, the project will go forward. At the same time, as Representative Pinto pointed out, it really is a key piece to helping the developers meet some of the sustainability goals that have been established for the site.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Representative Swazinski, that was your last question?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe offline you can answer who came up with those goals for that site. Was that the city?
Sounds like a follow-up. Mr. Pearson.
Kinda.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, the City of St. Paul leans on the state of Minnesota's sustainable building policy when they have more than, I believe, $200,000 of city investment into a particular project. So the city does have more than that amount invested into Highland Bridge and its development. And so they are, again, leaning on the state's building policy as the site gets built out.
Mr. Chair, if I may very briefly.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. I'll just note for Representative Swazinski and the members that this really has been a more than 15-year process in this. And I was on our neighborhood district council. I actually think I was not even on the council at that point back in 2007. This has been a huge effort by neighbors and the city that with Ford and then eventually with Ryan Companies, you're hearing from Excel. It's a real partnership and it's a pretty extraordinary site. And so these clean energy goals have been developed along the way and a lot of other goals in terms of how the development works that have been developed over a number of years in partnership between a lot of groups. So it's really, this has been a real partnership. And I'll say you all, by the way, should come on down and check it out because already a lot of the development is going. A lot of the infrastructure is in place and homes and all going in. It's pretty amazing. Thanks.
Thank you. And just reminded me of one other question. Just from a remediation standpoint, you know, in the contract, let's say that there is a problem with the dump underneath it at some point in the next 50 years with the solar. Is there anything written in the contract, Mr. Pearson or Pinto, that would allow for some sort of remediation for the dump if it was leaking or something along those lines to dig the thing up and do something? How would that work?
Mr. Pearson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, you've hit the nail on the head. Ford Motor Company will be the responsible party. And so if that were to occur and they needed to take corrective action, they would be the party to do so. And we just want to make sure that the construction of the solar array does not get in the way of that process. And so that's why we brought this idea forward after really spending a lot of time talking with the community and weighing these different interests. And so to ensure that that process wouldn't be disrupted from our plans, we're wanting to use the RDA to lean on in the event that a corrective action determination adversely impacted the solar array.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Good questions, Representative Swazinski. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my question is for Mr. Pearson also. You know, does this project solar provide baseload electricity similar to hydro, nuclear, or clean coal? And if not, what is the backup to project so that residents and citizens and businesses do have baseload electricity? Thank you.
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, good question. Solar does not provide that type of energy. At the same time, this is a contract that we're looking to enter into with the developer. So we would bring this power in onto our system and provide that as part of our mix. And obviously, as a utility, we've got a lot of different generation resources, and so we would lean on our entire system to ensure the reliability of the Highland Bridge area as well as the rest of the areas that we serve.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for that response, Mr. Pearson. And then once, you know, regardless how long this project lasts, and there's various projections, of course, the alternative energy people tend to project decades, while the non alternative energy engineers and scientists say less than a decade or just over a decade. Anyway, when something happens, who's going to be responsible for cleaning this site up?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and members, another excellent question. In this particular case, that would reside on the owner of the array, which is the solar developer. And so, again, because there hasn't been any contracts fully executed, all of those type of details are not yet have not yet been determined. But that would fall to the owner of the solar array, which in this case would not be Xcel Energy. We're just the off-taker.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Briefly, Representative Greenhagen.
Yeah, what happens so often in a lot of these situations, what I've observed, is the company, when it's time to spend millions of dollars to clean the site up, they go bankrupt, and all of a sudden the taxpayer's on the hook to pick up the whole tax. So I hope you put something in the contract that this doesn't happen, because we've seen it happen in a number of areas where taxpayers, regardless of whether it's solar or something else, all of a sudden they get stuck with the bill. Thank you.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gosh, I just lost my little Zoom thing there. So, Jim, I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but I just want to, you know, for the record, where will these solar panels, could you give us a little background on where they're going to be sourced? Are they going to be sourced ethically, or are the products coming from places that utilize slave labor and child labor, such as in the Congo or in China?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, again, another excellent question. That I can't answer it at this time. Obviously, this bill has a huge impact on the ability of the project to move forward, as well as the subsequent PUC process. And so if we get to the point where all of the necessary approvals are in place, we can then get into this, you know, into more of the specifics about where it's sourced and what happens after the end of the PPA and things like that. So these are all great questions to make sure that we're, you know, thinking ahead and building into the conversation as we move forward. But as we sit here today in March, I don't have the specificity to answer the question directly.
Representative Franzen.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I think before we utilize tax dollars and resources, that we really should know where these projects are being sourced from. You know, here in the United States, we're supposedly the land of the free, and the land of the free cannot be utilizing those who are not free and have no choice in order to build a green utopia, whether or not there are you know, regulations to meet, guidelines to meet. We need to look at the world as a whole, and all of us deserve to be free, and we should not be profiting off of the backs of those who have no choice. So thank you. And thank you for your time today, Jim.
I look forward to your support of our Buy Clean, Buy Fair legislation later this year, Representative Franzen.
Don't make assumptions, Mr. Long.
Well, given your concern over the supply chain issues, I'm sure you'll love the bill. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was in transit for part of this, and so I apologize if I missed any of this. But, you know, number one, curious the type of waste that's in the landfill and what happens if they settle over time, and does that cause issues with, because we won't be putting in deep footings, I assume. But also then, you know, who's the responsible party? I heard something about the owner of the array. Is that different than the owner of the site, and how do those two come into play against each other?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bowe, the site is covered by this concrete cap. And so the approach to this particular one is to use a ballast system. So we won't be doing anything that will be penetrating the cap. And so it'll be resting on. And so the developer has looked at the site, obviously, and through the bidding process and address sort of the engineering of that cap. In terms of the owner, the the owner of the solar array would be a third party. The owner of the property and the owner that bears responsibility for any cleanup is the Ford Motor Company. And just to give a little bit more color to represent Pinto's description, this site was used up until about the mid-50s for disposal Ford Motor Company. But since then, it has a lot of construction debris from other parties. The Army Corps, when the lock and dam was built, a lot of that construction debris was piled up in the same spot. So there's more than, the vast majority is construction debris, but obviously it has to be looked at in totality.
Representative Pinto, we've got 30 seconds left.
Comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so we're all super clear, right? So there's this nasty stuff in the bluff. Ford Motor Company owns that. They're responsible for that. Then there's a concrete cap. Ryan Companies, which is the developer, owns the air rights, and they want to put solar on top to provide clean energy. The solar company would then own that array, and we get clean energy for the site. The concern is if in the next couple of years the MPCA says, hey, we need to get this stuff out of the bluff, then at that point we'd want to be able to take the solar array off and be able to get at it. This is simply a backstop, a contingency for just the next few years, if you read the bill, a little beyond that, so that there is funding available if necessary to remove the solar array to get it. And what's in there, that may or may not end up being necessary. This will allow these residents to have access to clean power and make sure we can kind of be clean in multiple ways. Would urge the committee's support, and thanks so much for the consideration.
Thank you so much, Representative Pinto, for presenting your bill. I renew my motion that House File 3907 be laid over. The bill is laid over, and that is our business for today. We are adjourned.